adopted father was now sleeping alone in the marital bedroom, with Ruby and Jody permanently installed upstairs in my room. Ruby, on the other hand, was full of Christmas cheer, hugging me and saying she was thrilled to have me home, insisting that she and Jody take me and my two eldest sisters out to dinner for a welcome home girls' night out. "Jody really wants to feel closer to you," Ruby said, smiling in a way that made me feel uncomfortable. "Sure," I said. "What time are we going out to dinner?" "Let's leave here at 7. Sound good?" 7 o'clock rolled around, and no sign of Ruby or Jody. I could hear them laughing it up in my room. Meanwhile, I was starving. Figuring dinner plans were off, I made spaghetti for myself and my siblings and flopped down on the couch, throwing on Order of the Phoenix. Around 8 o'clock, Ruby and Jody came downstairs, all dressed up. "All right, girls, we're ready to go," Ruby chirped. "Already 8, I said from the couch, my eyes glued to the wizards battling on the screen. "Excuse me, you committed that you were going to go out with us." Ruby was incandescent with rage. I looked up at her. "Well, Mom, isn't one of the principles of truth being on time?" I said coolly. Mic drop. "Sherry, if you'd ever paid attention in your sessions with Jody, you'd know that another important principle is that you need to be flexible in your relationships." Which is why I went ahead and made my own dinner tonight. Very flexible. But I could see the shock in my mother's eyes that I would dare answer her back in this manner, in front of Jody, no less. "Your poor future husband, Sherry. I feel sorry for him. Good luck finding a man who wants a selfish wife like you." There she was again, wielding my apparent unmarriageability like a weapon. Any aesthetic misstep, any hint of individuality, any flicker of rebellion was so often met with the same crushing refrain. "How would any man want to marry a girl like you?" I glanced over at my dad, who was shuffling past, mumbling something about spark plugs, as if Ruby, with her own disintegrating marriage, was the arbiter of marital bliss. I knew her taunts of unmarriageable were nothing but poisoned arrows designed to murder my self-worth and keep me small and compliant, and I no longer cared. Ruby, sensing that her usual insults weren't having the desired effect, changed tack. "May I remind you, you're only an invited guest here, Sherry. This isn't your home, it's mine. And frankly, I don't want you in it if you're going to talk to me like this." "Then uninvite me," I said, voice sharp. "I'm serious, Mom. Just say the word and I'll walk right out that door. Save you the trouble of enduring Christmas with your inflexible daughter." I stood up, more than ready to grab my things and leave. But Ruby, true to form, wouldn't let me have the last word. "I can't take this abuse," she wailed, voice pitched to shatter windows. She bolted for the door, Jody rushing after her. I stood there, caught between laughter and tears. The absurdity of it all, my mother playing the victim card while holding all the cards, as she always had. Ruby and Jody went to dinner on their own, without any of us. My sisters and I ended up finishing the movie, and honestly, I was absolutely thrilled to have them to myself without Ruby and Jody's negative energy in the house. After the kids went to bed, I decided to wait up for my mother and Jody to come home. Might as well face the music sooner rather than later. Maybe try to clear the air. We had to spend the holiday together, after all. Close to midnight, Ruby and Jody walked into the house, both of them sobbing uncontrollably. "What's wrong?" I gasped, genuinely alarmed. "Did something happen?" Jody looked at me with tearful, bloodshot eyes, whimpering. "Your fight with your mother. It reminded me of my daughter. She left me. There's no greater pain than being abandoned, Sherry. You can't do that to Ruby. She loves you more than anything in the whole world." Her words found their mark. I imagined what it would feel like, truly walking away from Ruby, despite all the heartache she had caused me. Would the hurt she caused me every day be less than the agony of never being able to see her again? And how would Ruby feel if I shut her out forever? Suddenly, I realized I was crying too. "I'm so sorry, Mom," I whispered, tears rolling down my cheeks. "I never meant to hurt you. I'll never talk to you like that again." They engulfed me in a suffocating embrace. "We're so glad you're home, Sherry," Ruby whispered. And I noticed how wrong it felt, being held by the both of them. Chapter 30. Children are not entitled to a magical childhood. A few days before Christmas, the adults gathered us children in the living room. Ruby and Jody, addressing the four oldest of us, relegated my two youngest siblings to a corner. "We're making you aware of something," Ruby began, her tone unnervingly calm. "Your youngest siblings won't be receiving any presents this year." "We're teaching them to not be selfish and entitled," Jody added, her face a mask of self-righteousness. My father, ever the silent supporter, nodded along. I glanced at my youngest siblings. Their faces were pictures of dejection and confusion. Christmas should be magical for children, a time to feel cherished and celebrated. This punishment felt cruel and vindictive. "Furthermore," Jody continued, her voice hardening, "they must ask permission before speaking to any of you. If they interrupt, you must reprimand them. This is non-negotiable. We all need to present a united front to correct their behavior." "If they're not getting presents, none of us should," I interjected, my voice trembling with anger. "It's not right for us to open gifts while they watch empty-handed." Jody's eyes narrowed. "Sherry, your discomfort shows you're struggling with the consequences of their actions," she said, her tone dripping with condescension. "Yes, I am," I admitted firmly. "Do you want your siblings to remain entitled? Do you understand the suffering that mindset will cause them later in life?" As always, Jody had a knack for making me feel like I was always the one in the wrong. A few days later, on Christmas morning, 8+1 passengers gathered around the Christmas tree to open their gifts. The presents beneath the tree looked a little thin on the ground this year, and we all knew why. "Now, everyone, open up your presents, and in doing so, give the young ones the gift of this precious, beautiful lesson that will serve them for years to come," crowed Ruby. As the eldest sister, every fiber of my being screamed to protect my siblings. But standing there, dwarfed by Jody and Ruby's united front of adult authority, I felt microscopic, impotent, useless. We opened our Christmas presents while my two youngest siblings watched, wide-eyed and silent. When the flurry of torn paper settled, Jody's saccharine voice cut through the air. "Clean this up," she ordered them. As they wordlessly gathered the debris, Jody launched into a sermon, her face glowing with self-satisfaction. "Children are not entitled to a magical childhood," she cooed, each word dripping with poisonous sweetness. "You can't just expect love and presents. Many have nothing at all." White-hot rage boiled within me, searching desperately for an outlet. How had I let it come to this? I was supposed to be their guardian angel, their rock. Instead, I was a silent bystander, no better than my mute, nodding father. The voice of the widow of Nauvoo echoed in my mind. "Burn it all down, Sherry." I knew I wanted to, somehow. I'd always felt an invisible protector badge pinned to my soul, a responsibility I tried desperately to fulfill. But how could I be their safe haven when I was drowning in the same storm? Shortly after New Year's, I fled back to college, my survivor's guilt a lead weight in my chest. As I unpacked in my dorm room, the truth hit me. I'd abandoned my siblings to face the emotional apocalypse alone. I'd been thrown a life preserver, while the ones who needed me the most remained in treacherous waters. I swam in that guilt for a week or so, until a text from Kevin heralded new hope on the horizon. "Jody's feeling better. She's moving back to Ivan's." I hesitated before typing, "How's mom taking it?" "She's sad Jody's leaving, wishes she could stay, but Jody says she's ready to go home." I could picture Ruby's reaction, the facade of supportive friend crumbling to reveal the desperate, clinging need beneath. Jody had been her toxic lifeline, her twisted mirror of validation. Now, with 4 hours of desert between them, what would fill that void? A chill ran through me as I realized the likely answer. Us. Her offspring. She'd take her feelings out on us, as she always had. Based on the way she'd behaved over Christmas, drunk on Jody's empowerment, I imagined things might even get worse. I worried about the youngest ones, who were least able to fight back. Still, a spark of hope flickered. Maybe, just maybe, this separation would force some much-needed change. With Kevin there to watch the little ones, perhaps Ruby would spend more time in Ivan's with Jody, giving us all some crucial breathing room. In which case, Jody's departure might just be the best thing that could have happened. I would certainly return home more often to be there for my siblings, if it didn't mean suffocating under Ruby's presence. And being home would maybe mean I could get away from Derek. Things had escalated physically. He said he was training me for marriage, showing me the things I would need to do in order to please my future husband. Never all the way, he'd insist, as if this boundary made his actions noble. But he insisted on practicing everything else he said I would have to do as a wife if I wanted to keep my husband happy. "Your husband is going to be so disappointed on your wedding night if you are uncomfortable being touched like this," he'd say. "See how you flinch when I do that? You don't want to do that in front of your husband, do you?" "No, you're right," I'd say, convincing myself that this was some kind of exposure therapy meant to help me get over my issues and be a better wife. I pretended it wasn't happening. I kept my feelings hidden, deep inside. But slowly and surely, I noticed the colors of my world fading to shades of gray. Depression crept up on me once again, and suddenly I didn't seem to care about anything anymore, other than getting my homework done and making sure Derek wasn't upset with me. "How's your day? What are you doing? Who are you with? Hello? Miss you." Every day, his messages came in a relentless stream, every 15 minutes like clockwork. "I want to make sure you're safe, Sherry," he'd said. "Maybe you could share your location with me, just in case something goes wrong. I know you're all alone." I wasn't all alone. I had friends, and Kevin was on campus most days. But I was so hungry for any scrap of fatherly attention, any hint that someone truly gave a damn about me, that I'd agreed to share my iPhone location with him without a second thought. Before long, Derek turned into Big Brother, tracking my every move, grilling me about every little detour or pit stop. Parties, forget it. Boys, not a chance. A single moment of peace, absolutely out of the question. His messages took on a new tone, filled with longing and desire. Reading those words made me want to hurl. They also forced me to face the reality of what his interest in me was about. But even then, I made excuses, remained in denial. I couldn't make myself cut the cord. On one hand, his attention made me deeply uncomfortable. On the other, it was the only form of support I had in my tumultuous world. The contradiction tore at me, leaving me paralyzed and unable to act. "He's the only protection I have," I repeated like a mantra, even as a part of me screamed that this protection came with a terrible price. Without him, I really will be all alone. The truth hovered at the edges of my consciousness, too terrifying to fully acknowledge. Cutting ties with Derek meant facing a world where I truly had no allies. And so I remained in limbo, caught between revulsion and desperate need, unable to break free. As Derek's grip on me got tighter, I felt myself shutting down more and more. I became skittish, secretive. I stopped going to the dining hall, scared to death of running into someone who might start asking questions I couldn't answer. I cut off my roommates, quit my clubs, let any hint of a social life wither up and die. Dark circles bloomed under my eyes, and I turned into a ghost girl, washed out and hollow-eyed, jumping at every buzz from my phone. Sometimes I'd hover my fingers over my phone screen, knowing what I needed to say. "Derek, I'm sorry, but I can't do this anymore. I'm not your doll. I'm not your pet, your plaything, your anything. I'm my own person." And then I deleted it all, every word. It was easier to stay silent and play along than say something that would upset him. Chapter 31. Poisoned Well. One day, as Derek and I sat in his office, the curtains drawn, I tried, meekly, to confront him and address our situation. It took all the courage I had. "I don't know if this is right, Derek," I said slowly, my heart racing. "I shouldn't be here, right? Not like this. What if someone finds out? It would be terrible for everyone." He leaned back in his leather chair, cool as a cucumber. "Sherry, you worry far too much. In God's eyes, we're not doing anything wrong, and that's all that matters." I fidgeted with the hem of my skirt, my stomach twisting in knots. "But how can you be so sure?" "Sherry, I'm an elder in the Melchizedek priesthood. I'm responsible for the spiritual and temporal well-being of the men in my quorum. Do you really think I would do anything to jeopardize my calling?" It was true. He was a man of God, a worthy member. Suddenly, I felt very ill. "Oh, honey, you're so pale," he said, reaching out to pat my hand. "Stop with these bad thoughts. It's your anxiety disorder making you overthink things." He kept pushing, kept taking things further and further over the line. I didn't have those kinds of feelings for him. I wasn't attracted to him and didn't want him like that. But I was too addicted to the scraps of validation he gave me, the morsels of support he'd tossed my way when it came to my family. He was the only one who knew how messed up it all was, the only one telling me I wasn't crazy, wasn't making it all up in my head. I needed that lifeline, that hint of warmth in a world that felt hard and unforgiving. But it was confusing, crazy-making. My rational mind knew that what I was doing was wrong, while my traumatized mind convinced me to stay quiet and compliant. I don't know why I thought Ruby could possibly help, but one day, in a moment of desperation, I mustered up the courage to text her. I think on a deep and primal level, I just needed my mother, and it came out as a plea for her attention. I wanted her to understand that I still needed her, so I just blurted out my feelings. "Mom, I feel like you don't care about me," I wrote. "You never answer the phone when I call, but I know you're always talking to Jody. I just feel ignored. I feel like you don't love me." I hit send and immediately felt like I had just signed my own death warrant. What have I done? I thought, my stomach twisting into knots as I anticipated Ruby's response. She never responded kindly to demands for affection. Affection had to be earned, and it was always on her terms. She took her time getting back to me. It was torture. For 24 hours, I lay in bed, my body paralyzed, every ping of my phone sending jolts of fear through my veins. The next day, Ruby decided to grace me with a response. "I sense a lot of aggression in your text, a lot of resentment. I'm going to invite you to invite me to talk about this with you in person." So I did. I invited her to talk about it in person, and she accepted my invitation, telling me to meet her and Kevin for dinner at a local restaurant. I sat there, pushing my French fries around my plate, Ruby taking the reins of the conversation as usual. "You were very selfish in writing this text to me," she said, shaking her head. I sighed and shrank further into myself, not saying anything. Ruby fixed me with a penetrating stare. "What was your motive in sending me that text, Sherry?" I shifted in my seat, anger suddenly flaring in my chest. "Honestly, I was hoping you might actually hear me for once. And what is it you think I'm not hearing? This dinner was supposed to be about me feeling like I don't matter, like my feelings don't matter." Ruby glared at me. "Sherry, I need you to really examine your motives, because it feels to me like you're hiding something." And I was, but I couldn't tell her about Derek, could I? I just needed to hear, somehow, that she cared about me, but that wasn't in the cards. By the time dessert arrived, I was broken, sobbing into my chocolate cake, apologizing for being selfish enough to put them through this ordeal. "Thank you for allowing me to mirror truth to you, Sherry," Ruby said, patting my hand as the server dropped off the check. "And since you're an adult now, we'd like to invite you to pay for dinner." I nodded meekly and pulled out my wallet, watching as $80 disappeared from my bank account faster than my will to live. For days after that disastrous dinner, I lay in bed, catatonic. Every thought that popped into my head was tinged with paranoia and self-doubt. Is this me? Is this Jody? Is this God? Is this just my anxiety talking? I found myself truly questioning my own sanity, wondering what was real and what wasn't. I couldn't even bring myself to go to class. My body was reacting with physical symptoms that I couldn't ignore. What would happen if I actually stood up to my mother? I wondered, my stomach churning with fear at the thought. But I knew the answer. Ruby had the power to turn my siblings against me, to cut me off from the only people in the world who also understood the insanity of our upbringing, and she would pull that trigger without a second thought. What would my life look like without my family? I wondered, my heart aching at the thought. Immediately, I knew that I would rather endure this soul-crushing depression for the rest of my life than risk losing them completely. And through it all, there was Derek, whispering in my ear. "I see how messed up your parents are," he would say. "I see how wrong this is. Let me help you." He had my number the first time we met. He knew I'd been trained to fall in line, to never make waves. And because I had let him get close, because I had spilled my guts to him about the mind games and power trips that passed for love in my family, he knew just which buttons to push. My body, my space, my very being, none of it was really mine. So when Derek started pawing at me, started treating me like his personal property, I went away inside my head, fell back on that big fake smile that had gotten me through so much already. What irony. While all this was happening, I was studying abuse of power in my college classes, learning about the dynamics of coercion, about the ways in which abusers groom and manipulate their victims. But even as I intellectualized these concepts, even as I wrote papers and participated in discussions about the insidious nature of abuse, I was unable to apply that knowledge to my own life. my brain wouldn't let me go there. But deep down, I think I knew what Derek was. He was just another one of them. Just like Ruby and Jody, he was yet another one of the poisonous adults in my life, sucking the very marrow from my bones. Chapter 32, Seeds of Healing. It was one of those picture-perfect early summer days, the kind that feels like a slap in the face when your life is falling apart. "Sherry, I think you need therapy," said my bishop, watching me stare listlessly into space. "Oh, sure," I said. "I've done it before. I liked it. But Ruby won't let me. I'm on the family health insurance. She won't allow it." "Well, the church can take care of that," he said. "We'll cover whatever you need, no questions asked." True to his word, the church stepped up and covered the costs of my therapy and medication without ever involving my family. It was a weight off my shoulders. I settled into the plush armchair in my new therapist's office, the leather cool against my skin. My new therapist's name was Dana, and I liked her so far. "So, Sherry," Dana began, her voice gentle, "what are your hopes for therapy? Do you have any specific concerns?" I picked at a loose thread on the couch cushion, avoiding her gaze. "Well, things at home, they're not great." I willed myself to open up more, remembering how guarded I had been last time with Dr. Winters. Dana leaned forward, nodding. "What do you mean, Sherry? What's been going on?" I took a deep breath, trying to steady my racing heart. "It's my mom. She's very intense, controlling. I don't think she likes me very much." Dana nodded, her pen poised over her notepad. "Can you give me an example of a time your mother has made you feel that way?" I huffed out a laugh, shaking my head. Where do I even start? The words came tumbling out, a flood I couldn't stop. I told her about piano, about being pulled out of school, about being forced to be on camera all the time, even when I felt sick and tired. I told her about Jody moving in and my father shutting down. I told her how our house just didn't feel like a home anymore. Dana's eyes softened, and she set down her pen. "Wow, that sounds very tough, Sherry. It's a lot for anyone to handle." I felt tears prick at the corners of my eyes, and I blinked them away. I don't know how much more I can take. "Sherry, I want you to know that what your mother is doing, the way she's treating you and your siblings, it's not okay. It's emotional abuse." "Abuse?" I imagined Ruby laughing at us if she were here. "Don't be so dramatic, Sherry." But this was Dana saying it, a real doctor, and I knew she was right. I'd known for a long time. "Thank you," I whispered. "She always made me feel like I was just being too sensitive, too selfish. My last therapist thought I was making everything up." Dana raised an eyebrow. "Did your mother tell you that?" I nodded. "You're not weak, Sherry, and the fact that you're here, that you're seeking help and support, that's a testament to your strength." It felt like I was waking up from a long, hazy dream. The fog was lifting, and in its place was a blinding, brilliant truth. It wasn't me. It had never been me. The dysfunction, the chaos, it was all Ruby. It always had been. In the safety of Dana's office, surrounded by soft lighting and the comforting scent of chamomile tea, I found myself teetering on the edge of honesty. A part of me longed to unburden myself, to lay bare the complexities of my relationship with Derek, but I couldn't yet. When Dana gently probed about my personal life, asking if I was involved with anyone, I felt the familiar tightening in my chest. My palms grew clammy, and I shifted uneasily in the plush armchair that suddenly felt too confining. "Well," I began, my voice barely above a whisper, "there is this one friend. He's older than me, but it's not like that. He's more of a father figure, really." The words felt hollow as they left my lips, a half-truth that didn't begin to capture the complexity of my feelings for Derek. Dana cocked her head, her keen eyes searching my face. I could almost see the gears turning in her mind, picking up on the subtle cues I was inadvertently giving away. "A father figure," she echoed, her eyebrows arching slightly. "Can you tell me more about that?" I forced a smile, willing my features to remain neutral. "There's not much to tell," I said, my voice steadier than I felt. "He's just someone I can talk to, someone who understands what I'm going through with my family." As I spoke, I realized how true those words were, even if they didn't tell the whole story. I could sense Dana's skepticism, the unspoken questions hanging in the air between us. But to her credit, she didn't push. Instead, she steered our conversation back to familiar territory, strategies for coping with my mother's behavior and the ongoing family drama. As the session wound down and I prepared to leave the sanctuary of Dana's office, I felt a mixture of relief and guilt. Relief that I had managed to keep my secret, and guilt that I wasn't being entirely honest with the one person who was trying to help me. But I wasn't ready to examine it too closely, to hold it up to the harsh light of therapy, to understand why this was happening to me. Maybe one day I would. I just wasn't sure when. Chapter 33, Puppets and Puppeteers. In June 2022, between my freshman and sophomore years, the Frankies gathered for our annual photo shoot, the last time the eight of us would ever be in the same place again as a family. When we arrived at the small clearing overlooking the valley, the scene was breathtaking. Wildflowers dotted the hillside in a riot of color. The light was golden and buttery, the kind of light photographers dream about. It should have been perfect. Ruby's eyes were darting around the clearing, her gaze sharp and assessing. When they landed on Dwight, our three-year-old Cavapoo, her lip curled in distaste. He was sitting at Kevin's feet, his tongue lolling happily, his tail thumping against the ground in a steady rhythm, oblivious to the crackle of unspoken anger in the air. "I don't want him in my pictures," Ruby said. "He's not part of the family. He's a dog." I felt a hot rush of anger. Dwight was a part of our family, a constant source of love and comfort in a household sorely lacking in both. How could she say he didn't belong? But the kids pushed back. We all wanted Dwight there. Maybe it was the heat or the pressure of the photographer's curious gaze, or maybe some small part of her recognized the need to preserve at least the illusion of unity. But Ruby relented. Dwight would make the cut. We arranged ourselves for the camera as we always had. Dwight nestled in the center of our strained, uncomfortable poses. As the camera clicked and whirred, I felt detached, like I was watching the scene unfold from outside my own body. Ruby's smile was fixed and brittle, her eyes hard. Kevin's expression was distant and closed off. And the rest of us wore expressions painted on like masks. The smiles were too wide, the eyes too bright. When the photographer tried to coax Kevin and Ruby into a kiss, Ruby flat out refused and turned away from him as though he were a stranger. The result was the most awkward family photos in the history of family photos. No amount of Photoshop could ever fix that. Even Dwight looked a little off, like he could sense the tension radiating from us in waves. He knew a sinking ship when he saw one. In the car ride home, I caught Chad's eye in the rearview mirror. I think we both sensed the ground was about to shift beneath our feet, the carefully constructed edifice of our family life about to come crashing down around us. Shortly after the shoot, Kevin and Ruby prepared for our annual summer trip to the Wasatch Mountains, an hour's drive away. This getaway was supposed to be a family bonding experience, but this year they decided to leave Chad and the two youngest kids behind, deeming them too selfish to come along. Because nothing says family bonding like excluding half the family. They had invited me, but I declined due to classes. Kevin then texted our family group chat, including me, Ruby, and Chad, asking if I could watch the little ones while they were gone. I agreed without hesitation, but asked if he could cover my gas money, since I'd be driving back and forth from campus daily on a tight budget. Kevin agreed. While they were up in the mountains, Kevin invited Chad and me to visit for a day. I thought it was a nice gesture. "Yes, we'd love to join," I texted back. "By the way, are you guys still willing to help with gas?" Kevin's response was swift and cold. "No, Sherry. You have plenty of money for gas, and we have offered to purchase your lunch. If somebody invites you to join them at an event, it's brazen and impolite to ask them to pay for your gas." The abrupt shift in his tone left me stunned. One moment, I was a responsible adult entrusted with childcare. The next, I was an ungrateful child being scolded for my brazen behavior. I was so confused. "Okay," I wrote. "It's just, when you asked me a few months ago to stay with the kids, you agreed to pay for my gas." "Sherry, I hope you can see the difference between these two requests. They are very different. Please do not make money your god. Obsessing over and pursuing money will destroy every beautiful relationship in your life. That's true for everybody." "Huh?" Kevin had never, ever talked to me like this before, but it sounded exactly like something Ruby would say. It had her fingerprints all over it, her signature blend of holier-than-thou rhetoric and connection-style criticism. But coming from my dad, it felt like a knife to the heart. Maybe this is just a momentary lapse, I thought, even as the doubts swirled in my mind. Because the alternative, the idea that my father was truly lost to me, that the person I loved had been completely erased and rewritten in Ruby's image, was too devastating to contemplate. I tried to defuse the situation. Very good advice. I've been trying to keep a budget, so that is just something I'm aware of. But I'm happy to spend the gas money in order to spend time with my siblings and build family relationships. Then Ruby chimed in. Sherry, I'm deeply concerned for you. Can you see that what Dad offered you was not advice? He was giving you feedback on your presentation. We offer it because we love you. Rather than sidestep the feedback, it would be better for you to thoughtfully consider it and get curious if you don't see it. Okay, I responded, not knowing what else to say. My fingers hovered over my phone. I wanted to write something that could break through and reach the dad I once knew. But after several agonizing minutes, I had nothing. Who are you, Kevin, and what have you done with my father? Kevin had about as much autonomy as a wet noodle in a hurricane. His every thought and action was dictated by the whims of his unhinged masters, Ruby and Jody. The groundwork had been laid long ago, the seeds of doubt and obedience sown deep, as it had with me. The only difference was, I'd gotten out. Years of subservience to Ruby had left Kevin's psyche weakened, and now he was easy prey, low-hanging fruit. With meticulous precision, Jody had finished the job, dismantling the last remnants of Kevin's independence, stripping away layer after layer until nothing remained but a pliant puppet awaiting her command. With all her pieces in place, Jody was poised to make her final move, to eliminate Kevin completely. Chapter 34. Facsimile Father. As a high-ranking member of Connections, Kevin was duty-bound to make his weekly confessions to Jody, each call a ruthless dissection of his psyche, picking apart the carcass of what remained of his self-worth, just like my sessions with Jody had been. One innocent incident from my childhood had become a major weapon in Jody's arsenal. I was 5 years old, and Ruby had made chicken Alfredo for dinner. I had developed an intense hatred for chicken Alfredo, and spent the entire meal hiding under the kitchen table, refusing to take a single bite. At the end of the dinner, Kevin snuck me a bowl of ice cream. He slid it right under the table, like we were secret agents on a covert mission. It was such a small thing, but it meant the world to me. My dad, my hero, making sure I didn't go to bed with an empty stomach. That memory had always made me smile, until he told Jody about it. Now, that bowl of ice cream was one of many exhibits in the case against Kevin's character. "Do you see how you were being entitled in that moment?" she told Kevin. "Giving her ice cream, undermining Ruby's authority as a mother?" Alongside this, there was the damning evidence of his lustfulness in noticing an attractive woman at the gym, not even talking to her, mind you, just noticing, and the unforgivable crime of speaking to a female coworker. That long-ago act of kindness was now proof of his extreme distortion. Jody saw sex everywhere, in every interaction, every glance, every fleeting thought. In her mind, the world was a cesspool of lust and distortion, a roiling sea of desire, a 21st-century Sodom and Gomorrah, with only her twisted version of truth offering any salvation. A part of me pitied her, a repressed, self-loathing, deeply damaged woman, trapped in an environment in which she felt compelled to conceal her true nature. Surrounded by women she couldn't have, women who were married to men she resented, in her mind, there was only one path to justice: crush the sperm donors and liberate the females. In the twisted matriarchy Jody had orchestrated, Kevin's innermost thoughts were a weapon to be wielded against him. With ruthless precision, Jody would extract each secret shame, each hidden doubt, and turn it back upon him in service of her one true goal, to claim Ruby as her own, knowing full well that Kevin's shattered spirit no longer had the strength to fight back. The accusations took an even darker turn when Jody twisted the happiness he felt in hugging his daughters into something sinister and perverse. She filled his mind with doubts and self-loathing, making him second-guess every interaction, every display of affection. "Can you see how messed up it was when you gave your girls those hugs? You enjoyed it, didn't you?" Jody would ask. I can only imagine the horror and disgust that filled Kevin's mind. The shame, the fear, the sickening idea that he might not be a safe person for his own children to be around. It was all nonsense, of course, but these kinds of sexual accusations were Jody's go-to tactics, her nuclear option in the game of psychological warfare. She had used it time and time again to tear families apart, planting seeds of doubt and spinning false narratives of incestuous thoughts, infidelity, or porn addiction. And once the accusations were made, the supposed perpetrator was as good as done for. It was only a matter of time before they'd be invited to leave. The Haymans had been a constant in my life since high school, when Mr. Hayman, my teacher, had become the first adult I felt safe confiding in about Ruby's behavior. As that summer of 2022 unfolded, Mr. Hayman and his wife realized just how dysfunctional things had become at home. One day, Mrs. Hayman pressed a shiny new key into my palm. "Sherry, sweetie," she said, her eyes filled with warmth and concern, "you're always welcome here, anytime. Our home is your home." That's why, one muggy midsummer evening in July 2022, I found myself driving to their house. I had chosen to stay at college during the summer break, reluctant to return home. But on this particular night, I couldn't face the solitude of my dorm room, either. Almost without conscious thought, I knew where I wanted to be. The Haymans didn't know my parents too well. They had briefly taken one of Jody's classes when I was a freshman in college, but quickly dismissed connections as dumb and dropped out after only a few weeks. Ironically, this fleeting exposure proved invaluable, giving them just enough insight to understand the world I was trapped in without being pulled into its orbit. Their daughter, who was close to my age, had become like a sister to me. We'd spend hours watching old movies, binging on Little House on the Prairie and black and white Deanna Durbin musicals from the 1940s. Their house, always filled with laughter and warmth, had become my safe haven, a place where I could breathe freely and just be myself. I walked up to the Haymans' front door, let myself in, only to realize that nobody was home, just their dogs. Right, they'd mentioned something about going to see a play, I reminded myself. I plopped down on the Haymans' cozy living room couch, intending to zone out in front of the TV for a while. Just as I reached for the remote, my phone buzzed, Kevin's name flashing across the screen. I answered the call. "Hey, Dad." "Are you alone?" he asked, his voice serious. "Yeah, why?" I replied, unease creeping up my spine. "Your mom and I need to talk to you," he said. I heard the faint echo that told me I was on speakerphone, though Ruby remained silent. My mind raced, immediately jumping to worst-case scenarios. Have they found out about Derek? "Sherry, I don't know how to say this." I gripped the phone tighter, my palms sweating. "Just say it, Dad, please." "Your mom has invited me to leave the family home so I can work on myself," he said, his voice cracking. "Once I'm better, I'll come back and we can be a happy family again. I'll be gone for at least a year." The words hit me like a sucker punch. "A year?" Tears streamed down my face as I choked out. "You're moving out of the house? Leaving the kids?" Kevin sighed heavily. "Yes, I'm leaving and taking Chad with me. Chad is also selfish, and I guess selfish people belong together." "I don't want you to end up like me, Sherry," he continued. "Maybe this can be a learning experience for you." "Learning experience? Is he serious right now?" I thought, my mind reeling. Kevin then dropped another bombshell. He wouldn't be communicating with the other kids, only me. None of this made any sense. "How are you feeling about all this, Sherry?" he asked, his voice flat. "Confused?" I said. "Really, really confused?" "I understand, but this isn't the end of our family. It's the beginning." "The beginning." The word echoed in my mind, hollow and meaningless. When the Haymans finally returned home, they found me curled up in a fetal position on the couch, my body racked with sobs that seemed to come from a place deep within me. They didn't ask questions, just helped me to the guest room and told me I was safe. The next morning, I woke to the buzz of my phone, this time a lengthy text from Kevin. "Sherry, things have changed, and Chad and I are going to ask that you don't contact either of us until we're ready and we reach out to you. Please don't contact me. Don't be selfish about this, and don't hold resentment for this. Use this time to get close to your mom and your siblings." I read the message once, twice, three times, each word cutting deeper than the last. The urge to hurl my phone against the wall was almost overwhelming. Don't be selfish. Don't hold resentment. He was cutting me off with this poor excuse for a goodbye. How could he expect me to just accept this without question, without any explanation? The Hayman's guest room became my cocoon. Hours stretched into days as I lay there, my mind a labyrinth of unanswered questions and half-formed theories. But there was no logic to be found, no hidden meaning to uncover. All I knew was that this was Jody's doing. Journal. I went to counseling today and talked it through. I'm so angry with my dad for not sticking up for himself and for abandoning his family. And I am furious at Mom and Jody for ruining our family. I feel like a part of me has died and I will never get it back. I don't know how I'll ever recover or forgive them. I don't know how to help my siblings. I don't even know how to help myself. A week passed in a haze of grief and confusion before Ruby finally reached out. Her message popped up on my phone. How are you doing with all of this? I was surprised she'd contacted me at all, given the state of our relationship. Part of me was relieved she hadn't reached out earlier. I'd needed time to process. Still, her belated concern felt hollow. I'm having a really hard time. I'm really sad. Her response was as comforting as a bucket of ice water. Yes, this has been really hard. I hope that all of us will use this as an opportunity to become humbler, especially you. Humbler? Was she serious? I couldn't bring myself to dignify that with a response. I tossed my phone aside, burying my face in my pillow and sobbing until my throat was raw. A few days later, Ruby suggested we meet for lunch to discuss the situation. What's there to discuss? I thought bitterly. You've kicked Dad out because you're obsessed with Jody. Now the rest of us are left to pick up the pieces. Mustering every ounce of courage I possessed, I declined her invitation. How come you don't want to meet with me? She wrote. This has been a hard time for me. Text is what I'm available to do right now. My concern is texting leaves a lot open to misinterpretation. I left it there, unable to engage further. As days turned into weeks, I found myself reflecting on Kevin's role in all of this. He was far from perfect. Over the years, he'd made his share of mistakes, enabling Ruby's toxic behavior and standing idly by as she steamrolled over everyone. He was her faithful servant, catering to her every whim, no matter how unreasonable. But Kevin was never a selfish man. In fact, his greatest weakness was his selflessness. He gave and gave until there was nothing left. Now he had gone willingly into exile, cutting off all contact with us, his children, to please his wife and to protect us from the vile monster Jody led him to believe he was. He'd said it would be temporary, a year to focus on personal growth before returning to his family. But I knew Ruby would never welcome him back, no matter how much time passed. This was a one-way ticket. This was permanent. To this day, it's a miracle to me that he survived the misery of his exile and didn't end it all. A chilling thought has crossed my mind since then. Maybe that's what Jody and Ruby wanted. Maybe they were hoping he'd just disappear. Forever. Chapter 35. Care Package. As summer faded into fall, I found myself facing a new chapter of my life. Sophomore year of college. The relative safety of dorm life was behind me now, replaced by the daunting prospect of off-campus living. I moved into a cramped apartment with two girls, fellow students whom I'd met on campus, the three of us squeezed into two bedrooms like sardines in a tin. The stress of the move, compounded by the ongoing family drama, left me feeling raw and vulnerable. But nothing could have prepared me for the shock that awaited me in our new bathroom. What I had initially mistaken for sloppy spackling on the walls turned out to be black mold, creeping across the surfaces like some alien invasion, sending my anxiety into overdrive. Panic rising in my chest, I did the unthinkable. I called Ruby. As the phone rang, I realized how desperate I must be to turn to her for help. Mom, I blurted out, my voice cracking. I can't live here. I'm going to die from black mold. The words tumbled out in a rush, part plea for help, part childish exaggeration born of fear and stress. I don't know what I expected. Comfort, perhaps? Maybe even an offer to come and help me sort out this mess. What I got instead was pure Ruby, No sympathy, just a clinical list of cleaning tips delivered in her matter-of-fact tone. "Now that you're 18," she concluded, her voice devoid of any maternal warmth, "it's time for you to take care of yourself." And I tried, as best I could, to do just that, alongside my two roomies, each of us battling our own demons in our cramped, moldy apartment. One was a 26-year-old down in the dumps that she was still stuck on a campus she'd long ago outgrown. The other was a walking, talking pillar of faith, living her LDS principles with such an upbeat, unyielding intensity that even I, no stranger to conservative values, was impressed by the way she'd lunge for the remote and hit fast forward during PG kissing scenes in movies. We were a stressed-out little sisterhood, all very different from one another, but I found great comfort in not being alone, an odd sort of solace in these young women's company. I shared fragments of my story with them. They knew that I wasn't speaking with Ruby, for instance. But the full extent of my family drama remained locked away, too heavy to share. They didn't know about the unanswered texts I sent to my father, each one a desperate plea for some sign that he still cared, that I wasn't dead to him. Derek? That was a secret I held close. I could already imagine their eyes widening, lips pursing, and poorly concealed disapproval if they knew. Telling them, or anyone for that matter, would invite judgment I wasn't prepared to face. I couldn't even find the words to explain to my roommates what was happening with Chad, who, I discovered through some covert detective work involving sympathetic neighbors, wasn't living with Kevin, as I'd been told. Instead, he was out on his own, playing house with a bunch of roommates in an apartment complex in Provo, practically around the corner from where I was living. When I found out, my brain nearly short-circuited. An urgent need to find him, to talk to him, consumed me. If he was living alone, did that mean he was estranged from Ruby and Kevin too? And most importantly, was he okay? I racked my brain, trying to think of anyone who might have the inside scoop on Chad's actual address. I remembered that one of our neighbors was a big-shot landlord in Provo, and something told me he might have helped Chad get his apartment. I fired off a message to him. "Do you happen to know where Chad's living?" I wrote. "If so, can you please, please tell me? It's urgent." His reply was frustratingly tight-lipped. "I can confirm that he's living in one of my properties," he wrote, his tone maddeningly neutral. "But I'm afraid I can't give you the specific apartment number. Confidentiality agreements, you understand." Then, out of the blue, I got a text message from an unknown number. Building 6, apartment 38. To this day, I have no idea who sent me that message. I ransacked my kitchen, stuffing a bag with Chad's comfort foods, Doritos, Oreos, and those bizarre cheese crackers he'd devour by the fistful. Nestled among the snacks, I tucked a letter pouring out my heart, my love for him, my fears about our family's implosion, and my unwavering promise to stand by him as both big sister and friend. With this lifeline packed, I jumped in my car and raced to his apartment. I timed my visit for when I thought he'd be out, hoping to leave the care package and letter without ambushing him. The plan was to give him space to process everything on his own terms. But when I knocked on the door of apartment 38, one of Chad's roommates opened the door, revealing my brother in the kitchen behind him. My heart leapt at the sight of his familiar face, the same smile that had brightened so many of my days, the eyes that had twinkled with mischief during countless shared jokes. Our eyes locked, his wide with surprise, as he slowly approached the threshold. "Sherry," he said, his voice low, "what are you doing here? How did you find me?" I swallowed hard, suddenly feeling like an intruder. "Can we talk, please?" I said, my voice shaking slightly. For a moment, I thought he was going to slam the door in my face, tell me to get lost. Instead, he stepped into the hallway and gazed at me warily. "I miss you, Chad," I said, tears brimming. "What's in the bag?" he asked, voice flat. "Snacks," I chirped, false cheer straining my voice. "You know, for the bottomless pit you call a stomach. Here." He shook his head, declining the bag. "All good, Sherry. So why are you here?" I could feel the tension radiating from him, suspicion and anger simmering just beneath the surface of his carefully controlled exterior. What lies had they used to turn him against me, I wondered, my heart clenching painfully in my chest. I took a deep breath, trying to gather my thoughts. Then the words I'd been holding back for so long came pouring out. "I'm here because our family is falling apart. Because our mother is abusive, Chad. Chad's eyes widened, a flicker of something. Recognition? Denial? Passing across his face. Sherry, come on. I pressed on, desperate to make him understand. Dad leaving, the way they're isolating him, isolating us? You have to know, deep down, that something is very wrong here. Chad crossed his arms over his chest, his jaw clenched tight. The gesture was so familiar, so reminiscent of our mother, that it made my heart ache. There's nothing wrong, except that some of us need to work on our responsibilities. I reached out, my hand hovering inches from his arm. Chad, please, just hear me out. He jerked away from my touch as if burned, his eyes flashing with a mixture of anger and something that looked suspiciously like fear. I'm trying to protect you, I whispered. Can't you see? Mom and Jody are dangerous. Chad laughed. Protection? I'm doing fine, Sherry. I'm working two jobs. I'm paying my bills. His eyes raked over me, critical and cold. You should worry about yourself. Why are you so loyal to her after everything she's done to you? She's our mother, Sherry. I opened my mouth to respond, but Chad held up a hand, cutting me off. You should leave, he said, his voice low and final. And with that, he turned and disappeared back into the apartment, slamming the door behind him. I stood there, staring at the closed door, clutching the care package I'd brought, trying to gather my thoughts. I felt so drained, and the hope I'd felt just hours ago had vanished. Despite my joy at seeing Chad, the coldness in his eyes was devastating. It was painfully clear that my entire family had turned against me. I wanted to scream, to pound on the door until my fists bled, to make him listen. My chest tightened, each breath a struggle against the growing knot of panic. I had to get out of there. I had to lay down. As I was getting back to my apartment, my phone buzzed, a long text message from Ruby. Chad must have told her I'd tracked him down. She twisted my actions, painting my attempts to protect Chad as a malicious attack. The fact that I'd called her abusive seemed to have struck a nerve. Sherry, you have been deceiving me for quite some time. This makes sense now why you didn't want to talk to me. You couldn't handle the duplicity. It's clear to me that you are not interested in being part of our family, and you have chosen to disconnect by sneaking around attempting to harm other members of our family. I feel great grief and loss at your choices. I will honor your agency of disconnect. Disconnection means you are not interested in being around me and the family. You don't get to disconnect emotionally and tell stories about your mother, and then get the perks of familial and financial connection that I provide. It has come to my attention that you called me abusive. Wow, Sherry, that word is heavily loaded with intimation. It is hurtful you would use that word, knowing the pain that this lie has caused. This is my way of being very loving and inviting you to see the reality you are in. You don't get to use me or any members of my family. When you are willing to humble yourself and acknowledge your aggression and deception, I am open to talking to you. I will keep you in my prayers. You appear to be a very lost soul. You don't even know where the enemy is. Your arrogance has kept you from heeding my warnings. Love, Ruby. I hurled my phone onto the bed, its screen still glowing with Ruby's words. My hands trembled as I yanked open drawers, grabbing fistfuls of clothes and shoving them into an overnight bag. I couldn't be here anymore, knowing Chad was so close and yet so far away. And Ruby, her words echoed in my head, dripping with the cruelty that seemed to have deepened, if that were even possible. As I slung the bag over my shoulder, I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror. The woman staring back looked lost, hollowed out. I barely recognized her. With a shaky breath, I tore my eyes away. Hey, I'm staying with some friends for a bit, I called out to my roommates. The door slammed behind me before they could ask me why. Chapter 36 Fawn. After leaving the apartment, I drove straight to the Haymans' house, my sanctuary in the storm. When I asked if I could stay for a while, they welcomed me without hesitation or interrogation. I caught a glimpse of concern in their eyes. They could sense that things with my family had taken a turn for the worse. But they knew better than to pry, offering instead the quiet comfort of their presence and the safety of their home. As I set my bag down in the guest room, the knot in my chest loosened just a little, allowing me to take my first real breath since leaving my apartment. But Derek, for some reason, didn't seem to like that I was there. I hope you're not overstaying your welcome, Derek's text glowed on my screen. You don't want to be a burden. They're nice people, but everyone has their limits. His words lingered in my mind, poisonous and persistent. Suddenly, every kind gesture from the Haymans felt tainted. Were their smiles strained? Were their welcomes fully sincere? Did they think I was a parasite, feeding off their generosity? I found myself analyzing every interaction, searching for signs of resentment or fatigue. The warmth of their home felt precarious, like a fragile bubble that could burst at any moment. I cornered Mrs. Haymond in the kitchen, my eyes wide and pleading. "Are you sure it's okay for me to be here?" I asked. "I can leave if you want, or I can pay rent." "Sherry, you're very, very welcome here. It's not a problem," she said, fussing around the sink. "Are you absolutely, positively sure?" I asked. "Honey," she called out to Mr. Haymond, who was puttering around in the garage, "can you come in here for a minute? I need you to tell Sherry something." Mr. Haymond ambled into the kitchen, his face creased with concern. "Listen, I need you to tell Sherry that she's not a burden, that she's welcome here for as long as she needs. I think she needs to hear it from both of us." Mr. Haymond's face softened, and he turned to me. "Sherry," he said, "you are a part of this family now, whether you like it or not. You're stuck with us, you hear me? And we wouldn't have it any other way." I could feel the tears welling up in my eyes, the lump rising in my throat. "Is this what it feels like?" I thought, my heart swelling with a fierce, aching love. "Is this what it's like to have people in your life who actually care about you?" Despite the Haymans' kindness, I couldn't shake off Derek's words. He kept texting me, each message a carefully crafted barb designed to sow doubt. "I'm sure they're just being polite," he'd write. Or, "You know, people start to resent houseguests after a while." Deep down, I knew his comments probably stemmed from jealousy. He couldn't stand the idea that I had found comfort and support outside of him. Yet, even recognizing his motives, I couldn't bring myself to confront him or ask him to stop. Instead, I'd simply respond with noncommittal agreement, swallowing my frustration. It seemed easier, safer, to let him have his say than to disagree and risk provoking his anger. "Sherry, have you ever heard of the fawn response?" Dana, my therapist, asked. "Fawn response?" I asked, shaking my head. "What is that?" "Well, we often talk about fight, flight, and freeze as trauma responses, but there's a fourth, fawn. It's when a person tries to please or appease their abuser to avoid conflict or further harm." Dana leaned forward, her eyes kind but intent. "Fawning can look like always agreeing with others, even when you disagree inside. It's constantly trying to keep the peace, putting others' needs before your own, even when it hurts you. People who fawn often become hyper-attuned to others' moods, trying to anticipate and meet their needs before they're even expressed." I felt my breath catch in my throat as she continued. "In abusive situations, fawning can manifest as smiling and nodding while you're screaming inside. It's doing whatever it takes to keep an abuser happy because you've learned that's the safest way to survive. Does any of this sound familiar, Sherry?" "Oh my gosh," I whispered, my voice barely audible. That's me. That's what I've been doing my whole life." Dana nodded encouragingly, allowing me space to process this revelation. "It's a common response to prolonged abuse or trauma. Recognizing it is a first step toward changing the pattern." I sat there, stunned, as years of memories suddenly clicked into place with this new understanding. "That must be why I never fight back with Derek," I exclaimed, the words tumbling out before I could stop them. "I just fawn and make sure he's happy, because that feels safer." "Sherry, who's Derek?" I raised my hand to my mouth, my eyes filling with tears as I realized my slip. "No, I wasn't ready to talk about this yet. Is he the friend you mentioned a few sessions back, the older gentleman?" I shook my head, unable to meet her gaze. Dana handed me a tissue. "It's okay. Go at your own pace. I'm sure this is all very overwhelming, and you don't have to talk about it unless you want to. But understanding this fawning pattern may help." I nodded, dabbing at my eyes. As the session came to a close, I felt a strange mix of vulnerability and relief. Derek's name had finally been spoken in this room, even if I wasn't ready to say more. But now I understood why I couldn't say no to him, why I never rebuked him or showed anger. It wasn't weakness, it was a pattern etched into my very being by years under Ruby's thumb. Some way, somehow, I'd have to figure out how to break it. Chapter 37, Showdown. They gave me also gall for my meat, and in my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink. Psalm chapter 69, verse 21, King James Bible. Ruby's vindictiveness was legendary, and I knew she wouldn't hesitate to pull the trigger if she felt like she had a point to prove. The signs were all there. She'd already stopped signing her texts with Mom, opting instead for the cold, impersonal Ruby. I knew what this meant. I knew what was coming. Ruby always had to have the last word. She had to win. I better get ready for what was coming. She was going to cut me out, just like she had Kevin and the rest of her family. Then I remembered. She had access to my bank account. All my money, every last penny I had scrimped and saved, was sitting in an account that Ruby could empty at any given moment. I have to get my money out, I decided. That night, in early September, I set about transferring every cent into a new account, one that bore my name and my name alone. As I hit the final confirm button, I flinched. Ruby was a master of retaliation. As soon as she realized what I'd done, she would punish me. An email pinged into my inbox the next morning, a message from our family's insurance agent. Sherry, it read,